Welcome to Political Hitman on Israel News Talk Radio. Want to connect with Howie? Email him at howie@israelnewstalkradio.com. Now here's your host, Howie Silberger.
And welcome to Political Hitman here on Israel News Talk Radio. My name is Howie Silberger, and welcome to another season of Political Hitman right here on Israel News Talk Radio. I want to thank Tamar Yona and Israel News Talk Radio for giving me the opportunity to be on the air. No matter how sporadically I show up, it should be a little more constant this season. So I want to thank you all for your patience. I want to thank you all for tuning in. I want to thank you all for listening to Political Hitman here on Israel News Talk Radio. Once again, thank you, Tamar, and the Israel News Talk Radio team for allowing me the opportunity and the privilege of being here on Israel News Talk Radio. So it looks like the Iranian regime is about to fall. We've seen this before where it looked like the Iranian regime was about to fall and then they cracked down and then suddenly they didn't fall. So I won't count my chickens before they hatch. I won't rely on what it appears to be until it is. But the falling of the Iranian regime would not be a horrific thing for the world. I don't like theocracies, and I know it sounds weird to say that on a Jewish radio station coming out of a Jewish state, but theocracies really bother me because they never really follow the religion. What theocracies tend to do is use religion as a mask for dictatorships. And by using religion as a mask for dictatorships, what happens is the people who legitimately want to follow the religion for the beauty of religion, and every religion has a lot of beauty to it, regardless of how right or wrong they are in their religious beliefs, there is a lot of beauty to many religions, to almost all the religions have beauty to them. At the end of the day, people who just want to follow the beauty of the religion, follow the traditions of the religion, kind of get turned off by the theocracies that exist, by the countries that run themselves by religion, because they never follow the religion. They warp the religion and they twist the religion to meet their twisted minds and their twisted ways of running a country. So Iran was a secular country for many, many years before the Ayatollah Khomeini deposed of the Shah of Iran and took over the country and turned it into a Muslim religious country. Much like many other Muslim religious countries around the world, it became a radical Muslim religious country who believed and still believe that they are superior to everybody else and that they are the leaders in the spreading of Islam around the world. And they've taken that responsibility very seriously. And they've condemned people to death for speaking out against Islam. They have condemned people to death for standing up against them. They have condemned people for death for not dressing or acting in the ways that they dictate that their citizenship should act. And this kind of dictatorship kind of reminds me of the communist dictatorships, which went the other way. So religious dictatorships take religion to the extreme and persecute their civilizations, their populations, based on their religious interpretations, based on their religious zealotry. Communism goes the other way and takes atheism to the extreme and then persecutes their people in their country, people in their population, for displaying any form of religion. So they're actually polar opposites. So if you take a look at Iran or you take a look at Cuba, they are polar opposites. One a communist country, one a religious country. It's quite interesting in a theoretical political science point of view, but that's not what we're talking about here. The falling of Iran, who has been a state sponsor of terror for years, will make the world a safer place. Now, what will replace the Ayatollah in Iran? I don't know. And I hope that whoever or whatever replaces the Ayatollah and the regime in Iran will be something that will be I'm trying to find a word because I'm not sure what word I should use there. I guess the word compatible would work in that sentence. Something that would be more compatible with Western values, or at least with human values. and that people of Iran would not be prosecuted and persecuted the way they have been, and that world terror would kind of die down, and that there would not be state sponsors of terror organizations in the Middle East, and that might calm the Middle East situation a little bit. So I'm thinking that there's a lot of different values to the Iranian regime falling. But I want to hold my breath until it actually happens. So I'm really hoping that the Iranian regime falls. I think that would be the best thing for the world. But there's no guarantee that it will. Now, you take a look at different things Iran has done over the years, and you know, it's baffling to understand how they're still members of the United Nations, how they're still a respected country in the world, how the world hasn't turned against them. But even more frustrating is how the so-called freedom fighters, so-called liberators, so-called people human rights activists, that's what they call themselves, the ones who stand on the street corners screaming at people around the world, the ones who gather tens of thousands in the streets, hoisting the flags of terror organizations and yelling for their vindication and their victory. It's interesting that these people who stand so firmly against oppression and women's rights violations and religious persecution and genocide have never really stood against Iran. In fact, they hoisted the Iran flag at some of their rallies. It's mind-boggling, it's baffling, that after Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela was deposed by the United States and arrested, that these same people who were yelling genocide when it came to Gaza and falsely accusing Israel of committing a genocide there suddenly traded in their Palestinian flags for Venezuelan flags to support Maduro. So you see where the warped society has warped the minds of young people to believe that evil is good and that good is evil. It's amazing. When you watch the trajectory of that, it is absolutely amazing. And of course, it all started off, as we've spoken before on this show, with the Soviet Union having a campaign to destroy Western values starting in universities, and a successful campaign at that, as Western values have been completely destroyed in North America. There are no more Western values. And you see it on television, you see it on, you see it in the news, you see it in current events, you see it in education. And it's very sad when you look at Western values and the degradation of Western values and the complete destruction of what everyone knew existed before, and what happened, what exists today when it comes to the value system, the moral value system of society. We are basically living in a guttered society, with a valueless gutter society, a moralist society. And that's really sad. So when you take people who stand up and fight for evil, how do you handle that? What do you do with these people? And it's a very difficult conversation to have when you realize that anybody living in North America or Europe has neighbors who have stood up against good and sided with evil. It's very disconcerting to know that when you walk into a supermarket or you walk into a drugstore or you go swimming at a public pool, that many of the people who are there with you have chanted for your death, have chanted for you to be murdered. It's very disconcerting to understand that politicians that are sitting in governments right around the world have done nothing to stop people from yelling for the death and the genocide of people, while accusing the same people they're calling for the genocide of committing genocide. It's mind-boggling that this happens, and it's mind-boggling that normal human beings, normal people, haven't stood up and said, hey, one second, this makes no sense. Hey, one second, we can't tolerate this in our streets. This has not happened. There has not been a moral uprising. And that only leads me to believe that morality is dead, that the morality living in people is dead, that doesn't exist anymore. And therefore, people don't know that they could stand up and they could oppose this immorality. People don't know that they could get up and they could oppose evil as it stands in their streets. So good people stay home and do nothing, and bad people get out in the street and start screaming and yelling. And that is because organizations that run communities around the world, I'm not only saying Jewish communities, I'm saying all communities around the world, have made it a bad thing for good people to get into the street and protest. Governments have made it a bad thing for good people to get up and protest. And so every time people get up to protest anything, regardless of what it is, the media always portrays it as something bad. Teachers go on strike. The media will tell you, oh yeah, teachers are on strike. 14,000 students are at home. And parents have to leave their work and have to take time off work and they lose their income. And how could the society go on if parents aren't working? Who's going to pay for the food and the diapers and so on and so on? But nobody will talk about the grueling work hours that teachers have to go through and the low pay that teachers receive, the abnormally and sickeningly low pay that teachers receive in schools. Nobody will talk about that. So it looks like the teachers are the bad guys keeping the kids out, stealing the children's education, when they're just fighting for better compensation for the amount of hours they have to put into a job, a thankless job. So when we look at the world and how the world reports news, you realize that news has a huge influence. They say people don't watch television anymore, but the news still has a huge influence. Social media too. I have made the argument, and I will continue to make the argument, that social media has destroyed society. That society is completely the way it is, moralist, gutless, stupid, mainly because of social media. Social media has destroyed the dissemination of news. Social media has destroyed the concept of a conversation or an argument or a debate. Social media has destroyed it all. And it's very unfortunate because they did it on purpose. You can watch countless documentaries that will tell you that the founders of social media knew what they were doing, had psychologists working for them, psychiatrists and psychologists working for them to make social media as addictive as it is and to help them lead society in the direction they want to lead society. So when social media banned certain talk, and they did that for a long time where you couldn't post certain things on social media, Facebook, Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, whatever social media platform you use, they were banning people and banning ideas, banning thoughts. The thought police were out there. They called them fact checkers. It wasn't really fact checking. It was ideological checking. So when these ideological checkers were out there checking ideology and banning anything that didn't match the ideology of the platform, a whole segment of ideas, a whole segment of arguments disappeared. And suddenly it became illegal in the social media world to argue with somebody if you disagreed with them. It was my way or the highway. How many times, think about it in your own life, how many times did you post something and then somebody unfriended you because you posted an idea they didn't like, or you made an argument they didn't like, or you posted a picture they didn't like? How many times have you been unfriended in real life where people stopped talking to you because you supported a certain politician, or you made some statement saying that politician was no good, or you made some statement saying that you really didn't like something a country did or something somebody else did? It's ridiculous. I spent years doing radio shows with people who are ideologically opposite of me. I always had somebody way radical left on my show. And I'll tell you the honest truth. I was friends with these people. I would go out to dinner with these people after the show. We would talk outside of the show. We would get together for stuff outside of the show. We were friends. But on the show, we were ideological opposites, and it wasn't fake. The people I had on the show actually believed what they believed in. I actually believe what I believe in. But I understood that we could differ in ideas, but still be friends. That one thing had nothing to do with the other. Now, of course, if one of these people went and started siding with Jew murderers, which happened to me, where one of my friends decided to go and side with Jew murderers. That was the red line that you couldn't cross. So once you cross that line, that I cut you off. But before that, if we just agreed on ideology, then why can't we be friends? I don't understand why I would not be able to be friends with somebody who disagrees with me. It doesn't make any sense. But that's what the world had become. We had become so polarized that if I said something that they didn't like, they would never talk to me again. I have people who are upset that I questioned the veracity of masks during COVID and cited some medical journals that stated that masks weren't effective in stopping the spread of COVID. And they were so upset with me that they not only did they unfriend me or stop talking to me in real life, but if they see me now, they cross the street. And we're a few years away from COVID, but they still don't talk to me. This visceral hate that develops when you disagree with somebody in today's world is a direct result of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, or whatever social media platform you're using. On social media, you can say whatever you want, and you know people answer you whatever you want. They don't necessarily say it to your face, but they'll say it to you on social media. But that hatred that they build up, and it's a false hatred. It's not even real. And that's really the problem with it. It's not even a real hatred. It's a false hatred that's built up. But it carries over into life. And because you are politically opposed to what they're saying, they feel that you are the enemy. So we've become a society of thems and us's. The enemy versus me. And the old saying that the world is that I'm normal and the world is crazy really fits with what's happening in society today. And so when I get up and I say it'd be good if the Iranian regime falls, I know there are at least 50,000 people out there who will oppose that, who will say to me, that's not true and you can't say that and you hate Iranians. You're an Iranian phobe or whatever they want to call it, Islamophobe maybe, whatever they want to call it, whatever nasty, nasty, nasty thing they want to say about me, because that's the second part of this. Now, if you say something that they don't like, they say nasty things about you. There was a time when I was young that if you called somebody an anti-Semite, you said you are an anti-Semite, it actually meant something. The person got insulted, the person got upset. How could you call me an anti-Semite? I don't hate Jews. And it would be a big deal to be called an anti-Semite. The word has been bandied around so much over the last 30 years, 40 years, that it means nothing today. Calling someone an anti-Semite today, they just shrug it off. The word Hitler, the name Hitler, invokes the worst genocide committed against the people in the last 500 years. Killing factories were built under Hitler's name, where people were rounded up like cattle and sent to the slaughter. This is fact. It's, you know, there are people who claim that this never happened. This is fact that Hitler created a killing factories. He created a assembly line, a production line of killing, of murder. This is the embodiment of evil. And so referring to somebody as a Hitler at one time really meant something. It's like you can't get worse than calling somebody Hitler. Today, the name Hitler is bandied around as if it means nothing, as if there's no weight to the name. And, you know, everybody's a Hitler. If you say something that they disagree with, you're a Hitler. If you say something the left disagrees with, it's a Hitlerite. You're a Nazi. Calling someone a Nazi 20 years ago, even 30 years ago, was the biggest insult you could possibly say to somebody. You're calling them a genocidal killer. You're saying that they believe in an ideology that destroyed European Jewry, along with some blacks and some gypsies and some other people that the Nazis didn't like. You're calling them a white supremacist. But today, they shrug it off. Because we've dumbed down society to a point, and social media was a big part of this, because it killed attention spans. We've dumbed down society to a point where society doesn't even understand history. History's not taught in high schools. History's not taught in elementary schools, not to a great extent. It's kind of an afterthought. And because history is so untaught and people are so unaware of history, when you mention historical names, Mussolini, Hitler, like just horrific people, the generations that came after the Holocaust, 2-3 generations after the Holocaust, have no idea who these people are. When you say the word genocide, they have no idea what a genocide is. So that's why it's easy for them to get up and say, you know, Israel's committing a genocide, because they have no idea what genocide is. That's why it's easy for them to get up in Sydney, Australia, and yell, "Gaz the Jews," because they never met anybody who witnessed the gassing of Jews. They had no connection to gassing Jews. We knew we'd get to this point. I remember years ago, I was at a conference, at one of these Jewish conferences, we were talking about what would life look like after the last Holocaust survivor died. And that was the topic of the conference. What would the world look like after the last Holocaust survivor died? The last witness to the Holocaust died. Where do we go from there? And I remember sitting at this conference. Steven Spielberg was sitting at the conference. He had just finished Schindler's List, and he had just created the Shoah Foundation. And I had gotten a job working for the Shoah Foundation. And we were sitting in a room, and Steven Spielberg said, I'm starting right now. And this was just as he was starting it. He said, I'm starting right now a project to record Holocaust survivors, as many as I could. We're going to send out cameramen, camera people right around the world, and we're going to record their testimonials. Because that way, when the last Holocaust survivor dies, at least we'll have recorded testimonials and we'll be able to play it for future generations. It was a great idea, and I got really involved in it, and I worked for the Shoah Foundation for quite a few years recording survivor testimonies. Living in Montreal, Canada, the highest per capita percentage of Holocaust survivors in the world, there was plenty of people to record, and we spent a long time recording Holocaust survivors and their testimonials. But it took a guy like Steven Spielberg to do that. And did it help? I don't know, maybe to a certain extent. I'm not sure how much these testimonials that we recorded are being shown anywhere. But I know they exist. But I also know that through watching interviews of people that they really don't understand what happened at the Holocaust. So you had events and you had programs like March of the Living, which were great when Holocaust survivors were on the trips and said, I was here, and I remember this, and I remember that. It was compelling. Today, it's not so compelling anymore. And the kids who are going on these trips have no direct connection to the Holocaust. Their grandparents weren't Holocaust survivors. In fact, they never met a Holocaust survivor. So walking into the camp, walking into a death camp, walking into Majdanek, or walking into Auschwitz, is no more emotional than walking into a Holocaust museum or walking into a Museum of Fine Arts. Remember a few years ago, I interviewed a young man, a 17-year-old, who had just come back from the March of the Living. And his parents and grandparents didn't suffer through the Holocaust. They had escaped Europe years before the Holocaust happened. And I spoke to him and I said to him, so what was your personal attachment? Like, how did you feel when you walked into Auschwitz and you walked into a gas chamber and you walked up to a crematoria at Birkenau or at Auschwitz or at Majdanek? How did you feel? I said, I went on the trip and my grandfather was a Holocaust survivor who was in all these camps. And I know the way I felt was probably different than the way someone two generations younger than me felt. And I said, how did you feel? And the boy looked at me and said, you know, he said, we went to Mount Herzl and had the commemoration for dead Israeli soldiers for Yom HaZikaron. I had much more, I was crying. He says, but I really had no feelings in Auschwitz or Majdanek or any of these death camps. It was kind of boring, he told me. And I thought about that for a few minutes because it kind of hit me by surprise. I never thought somebody would say going to a death camp and seeing where millions of your ancestors were murdered would be boring. It was an interesting reaction. And I thought about it for a few minutes, and then I looked at him and I said to him, well, what were you expecting? How could it have been more exciting? And he looked at me, he says, well, I guess I just have no connection to the subject matter. And unfortunately, that happens as years go by and as generations go by. That happens, that the connection to the subject matter becomes less and less, and then the subject just becomes history. How many of us break into tears when we think about the Spanish Inquisition? How many of us break into tears when we think about the Ceausescu massacre in Romania of the Jews? How many of us think, break out into fear, into tears, when we think about the Crusades? It doesn't happen. We don't. Because we're so far removed from those events that the emotional aspect of it doesn't exist. And we're getting to that point now with the Holocaust, where we're so generationally removed from it that the generations coming up have no connection to it whatsoever. And so the visceral reaction that somebody in my generation would have when somebody says you're a Nazi isn't necessarily the same kind of reaction that somebody two generations or three generations younger than me would have. I have more of a connection to the topic than they do. I'm closer to the topic than they are. And I know that's really sad to think about. It's really sad to say, but time marches on and history becomes history. And so here we are in a point in history where Jews don't have really a connection to the Holocaust. The generation of leaders coming up now have no connection to the Holocaust whatsoever. The Jew haters are still using the old trope that Jews are just trying to get sympathy from everybody by exploiting the Holocaust. It's not true, but it's a trope that they use. And the young generation of Jews that are in universities and graduating universities and going into leadership roles have no idea how to respond to that because they're saying, we have no connection to the Holocaust. What are you talking about? I'm an American. I'm a Canadian. I'm a European. I live in Britain. I was born here. I was raised here. I have no connection to that whatsoever. What are you talking about? My support of Israel is because I think that we should have a Jewish state. Has nothing to do with the Holocaust. Has nothing to do with the Balfour Declaration that was over 100 years ago. Who cares about that? What I care about is that, we're being persecuted. Why shouldn't we have a Jewish state? The Muslims have Muslim states. Why can't the Jews have a Jewish state? Shouldn't there be equality for all? That is the attitude today. And so it's very difficult to train people or to even talk to people about supporting Israel, about being part of Israel, about defending Israel on campus, when the argument is, why shouldn't we have Israel? Israel exists because Israel exists. And it drives me crazy. Something else that really drives me crazy, I know I'm spending the whole show talking about things that drive me crazy, but it's okay. Sometimes we do this. Another thing that really drives me nuts is when the argument starts with the question, does Israel have the right to exist? That should be a given anytime you argue about Israel. It's a no-starter for me. So if somebody wants to debate me about Israel and Israeli policy, well, we could talk about Israeli policy from today till doomsday. I have no problem criticizing the state of Israel. I have no problem criticizing the government, the state of Israel. I've said many times that I think Bibi Netanyahu has time for him to go, that he's outlived his welcome outlived his usefulness as prime minister of the state of Israel. I've said this 100 times on this show. I have no issue at all criticizing the state of Israel, but I will not engage in a conversation which is predicated on the question of Israel has a right to exist. that is a non-starter for me. And the reason it's a non-starter for me is because you don't start a conversation or a debate with an underhanded question like that. Does Israel have a right to exist? Of course it does. Like every other country in the world. Israel is recognized by the United Nations. Israel is declared a state like every other country in the world. There is no reason why Israel has no right to exist. Now, we want to talk about occupied territories. We can talk about occupied territories all you want. Now, anybody who does a little bit of research will know that the San Marino Conference of the League of Nations declared that all of the Mandate of Palestine, which they created, was slated to become a Jewish state. It was just put into British guardianship until the Jews could get their act together and create a Jewish state there. We all know that that's what the resolution was when the Mandate of Palestine was created. And so who's occupying whose land is the question. Because the United Nations, when it was formed just after World War II, adopted all the resolutions of the League of Nations, including the resolution that said that all of the Mandate of Palestine, which includes what's now Jordan, a part of Syria, was slated to be a Jewish state. So if the League of Nations said then and adopted it, and the United Nations adopted all the resolutions as is from the League of Nations, then who's occupying whose land? There's a question. A question nobody ever asks, but a question nonetheless. So, you know, there's a lot of different questions you could ask, a lot of different things you could say when it comes to arguing about the state of Israel. But the one thing you can't argue is the legitimacy of the creation of the state of Israel. That's not up for argument. Just how much of Israel is actually Israel is up for argument. So you understand, but in order to be able to make those arguments, you have to understand history, you have to know history a little bit. You have to know that the San Remo Conference happened, you have to know the League of Nations passed a resolution, you have to know that the United Nations adopted those resolutions. If you don't know that, there is no way you could have an argument or even have a thoughtful discussion about the legitimacy of the state of Israel. So it goes back to the fact that education has been dumbed down and the left has really killed any historical education about Israel's history, about the politics behind Israel's history. And they killed it because it goes directly against their political point of view. I remember I was hired 1 year or a couple of years to teach Israel advocacy at a high school. And I went into the high school and I said, listen, I started the course off with, listen, I am teaching you Israel advocacy. I'm not teaching you Palestinian advocacy. I'm not teaching you Arab advocacy. I'm teaching you Israel advocacy. Therefore, I don't care what the other opinion is. I don't care what anyone else is saying. I'm going to teach you the history of Israel and I'm going to teach you how to defend Israel. Is this a propaganda course? Of course it is, because it's called Israel advocacy. It has to be propaganda. So I'm not going to touch what the other people are arguing. I'm going to touch what you need to know about Israel. And I taught Israeli history fairly accurately. And I taught about the founding of the United Nations and the League of Nations, San Remo Conference. I went through the whole gamut. After my second year teaching that course, I got approached by the head of school, who was a radical lefty, who said to me, I don't like the way you're teaching that course, and I'm going to replace you. And he replaced me with a guy who came in, and the first class he gave, he taught the children. And this guy came from the United Jewish Federations, of course. He taught the children that there is no conflict between believing that Israel could exist as an independent state where it is, and Palestine could exist as an independent state exactly where Israel is. There's no conflict of interest supporting Israel and Palestine at the same time. I'm not sure what he had in mind on how to superimpose two countries on top of each other. I'm not sure what he had in mind there, but that's what he taught the children. And the reason I know he taught the children that is because they came to me. I still worked in the school. I was just doing other things. They came to me and they asked me if I could explain it to them because they had no idea. And if they challenged the teacher or asked the teacher for an explanation, the teacher told them, if you want to fight with me, then you are out of my class. You're going to the office. Because, of course, it's my way or the highway. My opinions are the only opinions that matter. Lefties. And so the children were awfully confused. I was awfully confused. I had no idea what he was teaching them. And he went on, and that was the genesis of the course, was that the two countries could exist simultaneously on the same land, and there's no conflict at all. Well, if that was the case, and if that could actually happen, it would have happened already in the last 70 years. But it's not the case. Right now, Kahana was right. The only way for these two people to exist, and for a long time I said that Palestinians weren't a people. The so-called Palestinians, they came from all sorts of other countries. They immigrated. But right now, for the sake of this argument, I'll just use them generically as the Palestinians. For the Palestinians living under the Palestinian Authority, to coexist with Israel is virtually impossible. The politics have not allowed it to happen. The politicians have not allowed it to happen. And the hatred has built up for generations. And because it's so high and so embedded in society, there's no way for these two people to exist. So the only way for this to resolve itself is the complete separation of Jews and Arabs. They can't live together. So I have no issue with that at all. Create an Arab country, build a wall between the Jewish and the Arab country. Don't allow anyone to cross the wall, not even for labor. Let Jews do their own work and let Arabs do their own work, and don't do any trade with each other. Don't do any work. There's no labor coming in, nothing. Just complete break, separation between the two countries. And then there could be peace. Build a Berlin Wall and have guards on top of the wall. And let them shoot anybody who tries to cross. Then I guarantee there'll be peace. But until that happens, until people realize that this is a religious war, it's not a land war, and that the only way to solve this religious war is to separate the religions, there's always going to be fighting, there's always going to be strife. Now, I know a lot of people don't agree with this, and a lot of people are going to email me, Howie at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. A lot of people are going to email me and tell me I'm crazy and that my view on the situation is nuts. I know that's going to happen. But I'm good with that. That's why I have an opinion show. And that's why you could email me, Howie at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. I'm Howie Zilberger. Thank you so much for joining me. I will be back next week with another episode of Political Hitman here on Israel News Talk Radio.